This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.
It's like stand-up. The more meetings you take, the better you get at them.
Uh-huh.
You kind of figure out what the beats are in the meeting because it's almost like you're performing at it when you're pitching. And it takes a couple meetings for you to figure out where people laugh, where they don't laugh, where you thought someone was going to get a laugh, what part of the story wasn't clear, they don't get this character, why don't they get this character, are the stakes high enough in what I'm saying, why do they need to hear this pitch, and it takes a few meetings like that for you to figure that out.
Okay.
So the expectation should be not to sell, but just to pitch.
Hot Breath. Heidi ho, Hot Breath-averse. We're back. It's your favorite host, Joel Byers. And you know what time it is. Hot Breath. Oh, yes, indeedy. Hot Breath episode 1, 2, CZ. CZ is 7. We're at Hot Breath episode 127. Hot brethren and sistren, thank you for tuning in. We have a quick hitter. Today, you know, usually my interviews will go around an hour or so, but today we squeezed in an interview after my guest's final show while he was headlining this weekend at a Punchline here in Atlanta. This guy is an absolute well of information from not only performing on stage, but from the behind the scenes of television with his own pilots and writing and casting and producing. And really, this was a good interview that I thought we'd have more time, and then we ended up only having like a 20-minute limit, but it ended up working out great because I got to, a lot of the times you can start to practice, you know, well, I have plenty of time to get to what's important, but this interview really challenged me to be like, okay, what are the most important questions? Okay, let's get to those. What is the most amount of information we can extract from this guest in the shortest amount of time? And I think we did it. I'm super jazzed about it. I recorded it on my new camera that you guys can see on YouTube as well. We're shooting in 4K now. Yeah, we out here. So if you do enjoy this and find it a valuable episode, please just share it with friends and family and other podcast fans. And that's all you got to do. So there's only thing one we need to do. And that is inhale a hot breath with Vladimir.
Oh, yeah, that's
Camaño.
That's even better. Yeah, yeah. Let's do it. And you got your own mic as well.
Oh, sweet, man. Look at this. Professional rig.
Nothing but the best for professional. And if you get thirsty, there
you
go.
Awesome, man. Look at that. You got a little water.
Oh, that's got... Oh, it looks a little pink, but if you're...
Awesome, man. Thank you.
That's local spring water. They're called Fontis, but they do, like, custom labels and stuff. And they're based out of the Blue Ridge Mountains here in Georgia.
Hilarious.
On the hustle, man.
Yeah, man.
We're back. We're back now. We are here.
Oh, we're official.
We're official here now.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time, man.
So, no, you haven't been in Atlanta since, what, like 6 years?
Laughing Skull Fest, I think in 2013, maybe. I did it here at the, it was like a competition type of thing.
Yeah.
You've heard of it.
Yeah, they still do it. Yeah.
I remember I was there. Rob Hayes was there. Caleb was there. These are all buddies of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my kind of familiarity with the Atlanta scene.
Last night you did the 1 a.m. So what's kind of your vibe of the scene now?
Well, the comics have been so far like super nice and cool and easy to talk to. I'm just always surprised by these bar shows that pop up that always get packed.
Uh huh.
So last night we went to this, what's it called? The
Smithsall Bar?
Smithsall Bar.
Yeah.
1 a.m. packed.
Mm-hmm.
Packed. And comedy's weird like that. Like there are dedicated comedy clubs and nobody goes. Yet this den in a lair somewhere with, you know, leaky tubes is packed. And it was a fun show. We had a good time there. Did a little spot. And I got the sense that the Atlanta scene is kind of booming and picking up. So
Yeah. I guess you've gotten a vibe of that being in New York and LA with like Atlanta comics moving out there. You can kind of see the moves they're making.
Yeah. And there's some funny Atlanta guys, man. You guys got some good talent out here. So Clayton English and you know, Rob Hayes again and Caleb. You know, those are funny, some funny dudes.
Yeah. When you think about just you being working behind the scenes so much in TV as well, it's not as... Even acting and production and casting and all that. Do you think that even having to move to an LA in New York is as important as it used to be?
I would say there's no right answer to that. You know, some guys get lucky. Mm-hmm. Some guys go to LA, they hit. Some guys go to LA and nothing happens for them. I would say the difference is that when you go to LA, you should as much as possible go in with something in hand. Either you got some meeting set up, you have an opportunity that presented itself, because LA is very difficult to break into. You know, it's a very competitive business. And unless you have something cooking already, at least from the stand-up side, you know, I always tell people, like, New York, Chicago, or New York particularly has more stage time.
Yeah.
So rather than go to LA, you're better off building your career at a place like New York, getting funnier, meeting people, networking. And then when your career has some notoriety, you go to LA because now you're able to have the proper meetings.
Yeah, because you start in New York, then you go to Montreal, and from boom, there you get NBC pilot, move to LA,
yeah.
Chase the dream.
Yeah. And I was kind of an old story because I went to Just for Laughs.
Yeah.
My friend John was there with me. And, you know, I was one of that age-old story. Like, you go to Just for Laughs, you get a development deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the Warner Brothers, and I sold the show to NBC. And then I moved to L.A.
With the heat.
With the heat.
You moved with something in hand,
yeah,
like you said.
I had a real opportunity. I'd been before just to meet comics and do some stage time.
Uh-huh.
But then I made a commitment to physically stay out there.
How important is social media now in leveraging those kind of opportunities?
I don't know, man. I still don't understand. I still don't get social media.
Yeah.
Because, like, a lot of guys, some guys have enormous numbers of social media, and then it doesn't translate into actual engagement, like live shows. And you have other guys who have amazing social media followings who can't act.
Right.
But they just get at their own little thing, mm-hmm. but they make a ton of money off that.
Yeah.
And then there's guys who, like, you barely know, who are amazing writers and making a lot of money, but they just kind of operate in the quiet. So I still don't know how to answer that question, the whole social media thing. Like, you know, it all started with Dane Cook and the MySpace and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I know, because I know guys that are working regularly and they have like 400 Instagram followers, but they get bit parts all the time on you know, shows, and no one even knows about them.
And a lot of the times people think followers translate to dollars, and that I didn't know, because the cool thing about your story is you're funny, which is always nice commodity to have when people are trying to make money off of talent. But it's also, you've been in front of the camera and behind the camera. You've kind of gotten a 360 view of the entire experience. You know, you want to be a showrunner, kind of have your own studio when you keep climbing in this.
Yeah.
So it seems like social media is almost more important than actual talent now. Has there been a buzz around that you've heard from behind the scenes or anything?
I think the word comedian has expanded.
Okay.
You know, it's stand-up, it's writing, it's acting, it's Instagram. The term comedian has grown exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're a purist, it bothers you.
Yeah.
If you're a purist stand-up comedian, the social media thing just bothers you. The little sketches, the videos, you know, a purist sees it like, ugh, that's like the lowbrow type of stuff. But it definitely has an impact. And the successful social media guys work very hard at it.
Yeah.
You know what it is to get up every day and try to have a new video every day, edited, you know, produced, and then do it again the next day and do it again the next day? Like, it takes a lot of effort to do that. And some of those guys are, they just workhorses. So, and that translates into other parts of the business, you know, later on.
It's good to have a diverse portfolio too, because you can get hot off one aspect, but what else can you do?
Right.
It's like, oh, you're funny at stand-up, but did you already have that pilot written? Like, were you ready when they saw you in Montreal?
Yeah.
Were you like, oh, I'm ready. I've done all this other stuff.
No, I was ready spiritually, so to speak, because
okay.
my whole act is about my family. So I was ready at that point. And then it was a matter of translating that into a sitcom medium. But I had it in me, and then I wrote the first draft of it. So yeah,
what are they looking for? Because you've pitched pilots, and a lot of comedians, that's almost like an unknown. Is we've been funny on stage, but to then write a pilot, but then also to take it to a network. How do you kind of shepherd that along?
A little bit of luck.
Okay.
You know, it's very difficult to get a show shot, like, or even, you know, picked up. Are you allowed to edit this thing?
Yeah.
Okay, we gotta say bottom board.
I was gonna say
oh, you're gonna say something? Are you gonna say
something? Yeah.
I was gonna say the reason I think that he got a pilot from that is because his act, it's very clear what his show would be when you watch his act. You
gotcha.
Know his family, you know his voice. I think that lends itself to network people saw him do stand up at Montreal,
mm-hmm.
and I think, you know, not everyone's stand-up is like that.
It could directly translate.
People got deals like that. Like, people watch Seinfeld or Ray Romano, and they knew, like, this guy, I can see the show.
Yeah.
Glad to act. I think it lends itself to that. That's
my opinion.
Anyway, go ahead.
No, it's
that's a good note. That's good insight to have.
No, that's my boy John Rudinsky. He's a buddy of mine. We did New Faces together in Montreal.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. he's a good dude. we finally you know got to hang out again, so it's been dope. I'm excited that we're kicking it again.
But that's, I have heard that like when you do a late night spot that you want to organize it as if somebody could watch it and be able to make a TV show about it. Like they want to know your story.
Yeah. So that was how I guess that's how I got it. You know, my act lends itself well to a scripted series. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got to L.A. and I had the right meetings. I had the right people. I got lucky with a certain showrunner. I got, you know, you go in the room, you hope that the network doesn't have anything that's similar to what you got. You hope you're coming in with an original project.
Yeah.
And you got a pitch, you got a kill, and then you get the deal, and you just, it's a huge wave of like luck and momentum that has to hit you. Granted, you got to be talented and you have to have the right people behind you.
Right.
But luck is also involved, man. Like, you know, I'm always grateful for the opportunity that I had to showcase at the right time, you know, with the right people that mm-hmm. saw what I could do. And then it's just, you know, I wish the pilot had gotten picked up, but it definitely took me to different parts of my career that I probably couldn't get to otherwise.
Because you made it all the way, right? Like, you guys
shot it. We shot the pilot.
Was there a moment, because, I mean, on stage you talk about, like, depression and anxiety. Was that a big contributor to it, is when it didn't come all the way
through?
Oh, man,
that was probably, it's more so of, like, a bummer, man.
Yeah.
Because you got this thing where you know it could change your life.
Oh, bro. No, you're good.
No, it was a bummer, dude. Yeah, because you have this opportunity that could change your life and kind of, you know, satisfy you creatively in a very deep way.
Yeah.
And then it gets pulled for a variety of reasons, many of them that are out of your hands. You're kind of mm-hmm. left with, what do I do next? You know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was a rough couple weeks.
I was gonna say, what did you do next? What happened there?
I had gotten booked at Crackers in Indiana the week I found out, and I go to Indiana. And it's the Daytona, like one of the Indy 500 races. So it's a hard weekend. We're not selling any tickets. Mm-hmm. So my pilot didn't get picked up. And I'm in Crackers, Indiana with like 8 people in the audience performing for a week. And it was rough, man. My managers had to fly out to be with me for the whole weekend. They came out to Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And we'd go eat at restaurants, talk, strategize, you know, try to find a silver lining. And I think Marcy needs to come in here, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, she can.
That's fine.
Yeah.
So that was a low point, man. Low point.
But you've bounced back. You've done other pilots since then. So like, what have you learned? What is insight you can provide? A lot of comedians listen to this. So what is insight you can share with comedians, you being kind of in the war zone like that?
I would say it takes a couple meetings. You know, it's like stand up. The more meetings you take, the better you get at them.
Uh-huh.
You kind of figure out what the beats are in the meeting, because it's almost like you're performing at it when you're pitching. And it takes a couple meetings for you to figure out where people laugh, where they don't laugh, where you thought someone was going to get a laugh, what part of the story wasn't clear. They don't get this character. Why don't they get this character? Are the stakes high enough in what I'm saying? Why do they need to hear this pitch? And it takes a few meetings like that for you to figure that out.
Okay.
So the expectation should be, not to sell, but just to pitch. It's like Tom Hanks. He was on Inside the Actor Studio, and they asked him, like, when he was auditioning, when he was coming up, his job wasn't to book; it was just to audition. He considered himself an auditioner, not an actor.
Okay.
And I thought that was a very important distinction, because now you just focused on the activity, not about the goal. You just focused on the activity. I'm here to pitch, and I'm going to practice this muscle, and I'm going to get it down.
How do you pitch?
So typically, you go in. To a production company or a studio or a network, depending on which level of development you're in. And it's typically the same thing. You introduce yourself, you tell them why you think your idea is worthwhile. And then if it's a production company and they like it, you guys then strategize to pitch it to the studio.
Hmm.
And if the studio likes it, then you guys come together and say, hey, we're going to pitch it to NBC, ABC, whatever it is. And that's typically how the ladder works.
Is television even, like, is the internet almost more, especially now with like a comedian on the rise who isn't there yet, but making pursuits to that next level of exposure, would you say it's almost more viable to even just pursue the internet outlets as opposed to try and go straight to the networks?
I think we live more and more in a gig economy. That's a term they've used for like, gig economy is like people taking odd jobs, Uber, TaskRabbit, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think creatively, we're also gigging. So if the gig is Netflix, if the gig is YouTube, if the gig is an Instagram ad, you take the gig. Like it's almost like this is the Wild Wild West, man. There's no restrictions.
Yeah.
You take what you can get, you leverage it, and you try to get that to the next deal, the best deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of guys get caught up in like, oh, I don't want to be on HBO. I don't want to be on Netflix. I want to be on Netflix. But it's like, no, you go where you get the best deal. If HBO has the best deal, you take that. It's not about which, you know, which network does what. It's like, who's giving you the best favorable position? And you take the gig wherever it is, man.
I'm sure there's some negotiation that comes into account with those.
Yeah.
And what kind of plays into that? Like a self-value? Like, how do you travel those waters?
Typically, when you're negotiating a deal, you're looking for the money, obviously. And then you're looking for, like, what type of exclusivity they want. Do they want to tie you down permanently? That's a concern for you. You say, hey, I want to do this project, but am I open to doing other stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes you find other ways to do it. Like, can you be attached to the producer? So all those little, and, you know, typically your lawyer knows all those.
Yeah, you got to have a lawyer and all that. Because I know, I mean, you worked with Bill Lawrence, who was attached to Scrubs and all that. So I figured being that close to the sun, that someone that powerful and successful, I feel like there's only, you probably absorbed so much.
Oh, no, Bill is a mentor, still is. You know, I still hang out with Bill. And just taught me a lot about the business end of script writing.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain objectives you have to reach when you're writing a script. For presentation to a network, character development. He taught me all that stuff and just taught me how to see this thing as a business. You know, you can't get too attached to your babies. You want your project to go.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's like elements of competing interests. The network has competing interests. The studio has competing interests. The advertisers have competing interests. And all these interests go into play for your show to get picked on the air. So he really had a great way of kind of detaching himself from the attachment and making it just kind of calculated. You know,
you said the word stuff when you're talking about all these different things you should include in your script. What is that stuff? Can you go into more detail about that?
So, for example, like depending on what you're pitching, you want to make sure that the story is clear. People understand what the show's about. You know, you'd be surprised how a lot of times you think something is clear, but it's just because you're in your own head and you don't realize you need more elements to bring about the storyline. And other things like having too many characters versus less characters, you know, how many pages you need to introduce the core cast, you know, those like, you know, how many different ways to put like utility players in a scene to bring the best out of it. So like all those little tricks to get a script ready.
So you would want to introduce the core cast within what, like 4 pages? Like
Within four, typically the core cast, depending on what you're doing, you want to introduce them as early as possible. Especially if you're doing a 21 minute, you know, comedy.
Right.
You don't have an hour to play around with. So in the first couple pages, you have to introduce the core characters, kind of the core dilemma. And then typically within the first act, you have eyes of viewer know who these people are and I know what they're trying to get.
And a pilot script, how many pages? That's 21 minutes. It's usually a page a minute, right?
If you're doing single camera is 1 page per minute.
Uh-huh.
Multicam typically is double that because it's like stage directions and stuff like that.
Okay. So that's what you would want it to be, though. If you were writing for a single cam, it would be like a page a minute.
Page a minute typically, on a single camera project.
Okay. That's good to know. I mean, a lot of people don't even know that side of the writing aspect of it.
What else can I say about the writing process with the script stuff? Like, whatever you start with is not what you're going to end up with.
Interesting.
The first draft, and this is old news, like the first draft never looks like the 30th draft.
Right.
It's a whole different show by the time you shoot it, it's a whole different beast.
Yeah, did your show start out as like named Vlad and then it's like Born in the Bronx?
It was untitled and then we moved it to A Bronx Life.
Oh, A Bronx Life. Okay. I know, I remember when I interviewed Tone Bell on here.
That's a buddy of mine.
Yeah, he was talking about, I think with Modern Family, with the craziness of TV was that it was initially about like an Asian kid. And then when they tested it, nobody cared about the Asian kid. So they completely shifted like the focus of the show.
That's how it is, man. It's a moving target because you'll find in the process of developing your show that there are certain tweaks that need to be made. Certain things that you thought were funny or not. And certain things that could be funnier pop out to you. Like, oh, that's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And then chemistry between the actors, the table read, little things keep pumping up along the way, and you're constantly making changes. Then before you know it, you know, you had a brother, now you have a sister, or you have a best friend neighbor who comes in and out because in casting and in writing this thing, you start to realize that, oh, we need better ways to make this funnier.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
But you want to be the show runner. That's like the
I want to be the Bill Lawrence at some point.
Yeah.
For the sheer fact of... you have a lot more influence and control about when you get to a certain level. You can you're responsible for the entire show. You're responsible for like who directs it, who the line producer is, who the casting agent is, who the script editor is. So to me, it's not just about the on-camera stuff. It's like you're responsible for the entire thing. And if you've seen good showrunners, it feels like a family. You know who your grip is. You know who your audio guy is. You know, for some guys, it's as specific as the caterer. I want this same caterer, the same woman that cooks the thing. Mm-hmm. And when it's done right, and I've seen it done right, it's a family experience, man. Like you have your own show. I mean, it's work, you know, it's work. But when you see it run well, it's like it's heaven, man.
Especially if you're like the end all be all.
Yeah, it's heaven, dude.
Of that show. It's heaven.
And, you know, like with Bill, for example, he has his guys working. Like, he's been working with them for years. So it's just like the efficiency of it.
Right.
They all know Bill's system. They know Bill's shorthand. They know where to be, where not to be, when to step in. And it was like, it was running like a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And you see all these people working to make something funny together. It's like, man, this is cool.
What are some major mistakes you see comics making?
Maybe we could
keep it in maybe the acting realm, or because it's one thing to be a stand-up comedian and be like, well, I'm just gonna get on stage, do my open mics, and work my way up. But to really diversify your skill set, what do you think are some maybe mistakes comics make that they could easily avoid?
I think for me the biggest thing is bitterness. I tell a lot of comics to stay off the Facebook and stay off the Instagram, because you can get caught up in who's doing what and who's not doing what, as opposed to being proactive and working on your own thing. And I would tell comics, because a lot of comics, you know, as we talk amongst ourselves, we hate on other comics. And I'm just not that type of comedian. Like, whenever I hear comics talking that way, I kind of step to the side or I just don't say anything.
Yeah.
I would say try to learn from each other. Instead of saying someone's not funny, rather say, let me see what he's doing that's working.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to think someone's funny, but you can respect them. There's certain comics I don't like, but I respect them. I don't think they're hilarious, but I see what they're doing. I see the mechanics. I see the work ethic.
Yeah.
I see the timing. I see the precision. I see the way they structured the order of this set. And I think if, as comics, we'd be better off doing that. We'd be happier. We'd be more creative. And we definitely would get more work.
That's what I've heard. Like, a number one thing is just be nice.
Be nice. Don't shit on other comics.
Yeah.
You also don't know people's stories. I learned this early on. Like, I met a couple comics who I didn't think were funny. But then when I got to know them, I then found them funny, because I realized why their humor was structured as such.
Mm.
And also, when you hear someone's story, you also respect them more. Like, I didn't know you went through that, man.
Yeah.
I didn't know you had that experience. I know your parents did that. And you have a whole different level of perception on somebody you didn't think was that good. So if you don't like somebody, take a minute to know about them. Like, learn about them. Like, let me find out what this guy's story is.
Yeah, it's like you growing up in the Bronx during the crack epidemic,
right,
to an abusive father. Yeah. And then now you want to be like a showrunner.
Lovingly abusive.
Lovingly abusive. I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah, I know on stage you always talk about like the good sides of it. But
lovingly abusive. My father's like endearing, like just overwhelming. Too much love, man. Too much love, my dad. It's a character.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's one of the things that drives it, though, I guess, to be able to incorporate those characters. Well, all right. We're at 20 minutes. I know you had...
You got to run. You got a friend.
You had your 20-minute countdown. So before we get out of here...
Yeah, brother.
Is there anything else you want the world to know?
I would say that last piece is so important, man. Like, just don't be bitter in this business. You know, I would say comedy's a beautiful thing. Like, when you look back on it, the guys you came up with, the fun you had, the late nights, the conversations, and it's something you're going to cherish, and it's important not to hate, man, because that's pretty rampant in this business.
I'd imagine.
A lot of cynicism. I mean, it's probably one of the biggest cynical industries we have is stand-up comedy. It's like just guys just shade and self-loathing and, you know, why can't I get an audition? This is the guy they give the opportunity to.
You probably got bitter after your pilot got axed.
Yeah, man. I told my manager, I said, these are the moments where you get bitter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you have to kind of grieve and you got to reframe it. And then you learn that there are other comics just like you who were super talented and also didn't get picked up. You know, my friend Adam, we're not super friends, but we're in passing, Adam Ferrara.
Mm-hmm.
He shared with me his story. And then you start to learn that, like, no, this is just the business. This is like, this happens to the best of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the best of us have to take a fall and some guys get back up. Dave Chappelle was known as the pilot guy. He made pilot after pilot after pilot.
Oh, and then, you know how many he made?
I don't know how many, but when I understand, he had a lot of pilots that didn't get picked up.
Uh-huh.
Kevin Hart had a show that was at Upfronts, about to be announced for pickup, and they right before he goes on stage, they said, "Nah, we're not picking up the show."
Huh.
So you learn that this happens to everybody, man. Like, we all get shots. We all get shots, and we're just blessed to have the opportunity to get a shot, and then hopefully it leads to something bigger.
Well, I appreciate you taking the opportunity to do this, man.
Anytime, brother. And hopefully when I come back, we'll do a longer version of this.
Yeah, no doubt, buddy. Appreciate it.
Thanks to you, brother. Appreciate it, man. Thanks a lot, man.
Hot breath. Oh, he said I was like Judd Apatow. Isn't that lovely? He was referencing Judd Apatow did this whole series of interviews back when he was younger, just interviewing a bunch of different comedians. He's a comedy nerd. I'm a comedy nerd. If you know any comedy nerds who do not know about Hot Breath, definitely let them know. This podcast is all about learning and sharing. So thank you so much for sharing your time with me. My favorite part of this Hot Breath episode was definitely diving into the whole behind the scenes TV scene. You know, a lot of us, especially comedians and just comedy fans that watch TV shows, have no idea the amount of work that actually goes in to developing these shows from start to finish. So that was a really good insight there. I'd love to know what you enjoyed about it. My Instagram and all other social media is at Joel Byers Comedy. Also at Hot Breath Pod. I post a lot of cool video clips from the podcast on there. And of course, joelbyerscomedy.com. If you'd like to come see me live, you know, I teach a comedy class. I wrote a comedy book with Dr. Robert Joseph. I'm performing all over the place. If you'd like to actually see other sides of me, joelbyerscomedy.com has all of that there. I host a show every single Wednesday at Java Monkey in Decatur, Georgia. I would love to see you there sometime. I've had people come out who have heard the podcast and are like, yo, the Hot Breath. And they make a, oh, oh. They always make the noise. I love that. So if you ever see me out in public at an open mic or at my show or whatnot, just give me a and I'll know what time it is. So thank you, Hot Breathiverse. This is super duper exciting, the momentum we're building here. If you want to be a part of it and help us get more exposure, telling your friends and family and other podcast fans really goes a long way. Also, leaving an iTunes review really does help make a difference. There's over 500,000 podcasts on iTunes, so leaving those reviews really do help us stand out and gain new listeners that way, which is what it's all about, just bringing awareness. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. I love you. I also love my engineer, Amon Garner. Thanks to him for always keeping these sounding crystal clear. And of course, I have to thank my wife. I'm contractually obligated at this point to thank my wife for making the theme song of this podcast, as well as the theme song of our podcast. It's called Buyer's Life. If you want to hear yet another dimension of my life, Buyer's Life is a podcast my wife and I started all about our lives and our to-dos, and we just went on our year anniversary to Chattanooga, so there's a lot of good stories about eating ourselves and drinking ourselves sick on there. I think you'll enjoy that I'm still recovering from. But otherwise, you know, this is Hot Breath. This is my baby. So let's hang out. Let's be friends. So if you're listening this far into it, then we are, and I appreciate you. So I won't take up any more of your time. I love you so much. And we release these every Monday. So until next Monday, right here on Hot Breath. Hot Breath. This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.